All right, let's pick up where we left off. We left off in Proverbs chapter 6. Keep this in mind, too, for those of you who haven't been here when we started this book. This book, obviously, most of it is written by Solomon. I mean, it deals with everything from drunkards to gluttons to fools to wise men. It talks about sluggards. It talks about diligent people. It talks about hope and despair, and it talks about anger and resentment. I mean, it just covers a lot of ground. And, you know, if you count the Proverbs that we have available to us, according to Kings chapter 4, 1 Kings chapter 4, Solomon had written over 3,000 Proverbs. Wow. And we're missing about 2,400 of them. So anyway, you know, like I said, the Proverbs themselves don't really begin until we get to about chapter 9, and then it goes to 29. And then chapter 30 is not written by Solomon. It's written by a sage by the name of Agur. And then chapter 31 is actually written by a woman. She wrote it to her son, who was a king by the name of Lemuel. And there wasn't a king Lemuel in their
lineage,
okay? But it may have stood for one of the kings that they had. She just called him by a different name. That's probably what happened there. But anyway, I just get to give you that kind of background, because what we're dealing with in this Proverbs to me is, it's a common sense book. And it's basically written, and Solomon says it himself, he's writing it to younger people, basically, but it really speaks to everybody. Because one of the things that just go hand in hand, let's face it, when you're young, you're dumb. I mean, there's just no getting around it. You just are lacking a great deal of, let's say foresight as far as consequences, as far as the future, as far as decisions. And that's why God, I think, had these Proverbs written down. Because, you know, I think really if a young person or an old person, doesn't matter who they are, if they really study the Proverbs and inculcate it in their life, start living it out, man, they could really avoid an awful lot of pain in their life. Because there's no doubt in my mind, I don't care whether people are on death row or they're in prison, or you look at a whole lot of these politicians that get caught with their hands in the till or their pants down, or one foolish, stupid thing after another, after another, after another that people do to ruin their lives. And if they take the time to study what God is saying to us in these Proverbs, I think, boy, we could just avoid a great deal of disaster. And so anyway, I know I just did that for the sake of people who haven't been here when we started this book. Anyway, beginning with verse 1 of chapter 6, it says, "My son, if you have become surety for your neighbor, have given a pledge for a stranger, if you have been snared with the words of your mouth, have been caught with the words of your mouth, do this then, my son, and deliver yourself, since you have come into the hand of your neighbor. Go humble yourself and importune your neighbor. Give no sleep to your eyes, nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand, and like a bird from the hand of the fowler." Go, okay, now, you know, just in these first five verses of this chapter 6, he's given some pretty sound advice here. What you never want to do is you never want to co-sign for a neighbor, an acquaintance, and you definitely never want to do it for a stranger. Because the fact that a person would even do that makes a suggestion that maybe this person who asked them this favor, could you co-sign for me for this? Could you be a guarantee or surety for me for this? They probably play on a person's pride, saying, well, I know you're really a man of God, or you're really a generous person, or you're really in a position to help me, and I'd like to ask for your help here. You know what? Solomon's saying, don't do that. Don't do that. And it says, and if you do that, then by all means, don't even give sleep to your eyes. I mean, go there immediately and humble yourself, meaning that you probably got into this situation because of pride. But see, the Bible talks about, and the Proverbs talks about probably no less than 40 times, it talks about money and the use of money and how to be a good steward. And he's just giving some solid advice here that I think that, here again, it could really save you a lot of heartache. But one thing I just want to qualify here, he talks about here, if you do it for a neighbor, do it for an acquaintance, or do it for a stranger, but he's not talking about, let's say, a family member. I remember, you know, I think my dad co-signed for me to pay for my first car, if I'm not mistaken, or whatever it was. I remember one time he did. Anyway, I ended up paying him off. But even there, if you got a family member, if you got somebody who's just kind of shiftless and lazy and undependable, and they hang out with the wrong crowd and they're using drugs, don't do it. I don't care if it's your son or daughter or your brother or sister. It's just a lot of sound advice. That's what he's talking about here. Anyway, look at that verse 6. He says, "Go to the ant, O slugger, observe her ways and be wise, which having no cheat chief, officer, or ruler, prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provisions in the harvest. How long will you lie down, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep and a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. Your poverty will come like a vagabond and your need like an armed man. Now, you know what? Here again, it's just only a tidbit of advice, but to me, it just speaks volumes. There's an old saying, people say, well, it's better to burn out than to rust out. And people have often accused me of saying, well, you're just going to burn yourself out or whatever, because they look at me as just constantly a perpetual motion. But you know what? When I read God's word, you know what I see? God's concern isn't so much that people are going to become workaholics. It's just the opposite. I mean, God's concern is, hey, man, if your life begins to characterize a type of slothfulness, it can really be dangerous in a lot of ways, especially spiritually. All right. And, you know, who can tell me why God made us?
To know Him, love Him, serve Him, and His will.
That's exactly it. I mean, if you look at, like, for example, in Deuteronomy chapter 11, you don't even have to turn there, but 11:13, it says, it shall come about, if you listen obediently to my commands, which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and serve Him with all your heart and all your soul, that He will give you rain for your season, etc. He also says in chapter 10, verses 12, said, now Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all of His ways and love Him and serve the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul. He says the exact same thing in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5. He says this, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and all your might. He says this over and over again. And when somebody came to him, came to Jesus, a lawyer, to test him, he said, Lord, what's the greatest commandment? What did Jesus say?
Love you.
He quoted this right out of Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5. He says that to love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, all your strength. And he said the second is to love your neighbor as yourself. And everything hinges upon that. Now, look at this. Look what he's saying. Love the Lord your God with half measures, being lukewarm, apathetic, indifferent, and ho-hum. Is that why God made us?
That's what happened.
Now, you tell me. Did most people give you an impression, if they go to church, that they're just shining the pew with the rear end and that's all they're doing in terms of their relationship with God? I mean, I'm not trying to be anybody's judge, but I'm looking at this and I'm saying this is said over and over and over and over again. And even in the New Testament, Paul says, whatever your hand finds to do it mightily as unto the Lord. And I have really tried to cultivate that in my life. I really have. On a daily basis, everything I do, I don't care whether I'm on a racquetball court or whether I'm on my job. I don't care whether I'm vacuuming the floor or cleaning the toilet bowls. I don't care what it is. I try to do it with all my might because I know this. Hey, everything you do is to be done for the honor and glory of God. I mean, that's what he's talking about here. But people can't give God the time of day. And this says a lot because apply this spiritually, but also apply it to where we live and breathe. He says here, verse 6, go to the ant, O sluggard. Observe her ways and be wise. Now, what's a sluggard?
Somebody who don't work.
Yeah, I guess they get the word from the word slug. You ever see a slug? How slow it moves, you know? He says, go to the ant, O sluggard. You see an ant? An ant is just, you know, a workaholic, so to speak. But he's saying, learn a lesson from the ant. Because he says here, which having no chief or ruler. In other words, you know, I work with a bunch of people, and I'm not kidding you. I have to pray every day because I work with people who I consider to just be slothful, lazy. I mean, it irritates me. They walk around like they're in a daze. And, you know, you've got to keep pulling their weight. You've got to keep doing their job. And they start working when they realize somebody's watching them. But look what this says. It says here, go to the ant, O slugger, observe her ways and be wise, which have no chief or ruler over them. In other words, they don't need to have somebody watching them before mm-hmm. they'll put out, before they'll really be diligent, before they really do their job. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not trying to boast here. I'm just simply saying that on my job, I try to do the best job, to be the most productive that I possibly can, and not to try to shine before people. But I realize, hey, you know what? That's what the Bible says. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it mightily as unto God. If you're doing it that way, then you're going to be put in an honest day's work, and lo and behold, you're actually going to get a reputation as being a dependable, hard-working, diligent, industrious person. See, that's what he's talking about here. You know, an industrious person can do more car with a busted screwdriver and a rusty pipe wrench than a lazy slugger can do with a whole machine shop full of tools. I mean, they're mm-hmm. just going to make a one lame excuse after another of why they can't do something. Where an industrious person is going to roll up their sleeves and say, well, I'm going to do it. And they're going to get off the rear end and do it. And when you read this, look where we're at today. Now, Paul says this in the New Testament. He says, he who will not work, neither let him eat. He didn't say he who cannot work, because there are a number of people who cannot work. They're physically, mentally, emotionally, or something handicapped. All right, I'm all for giving these people a free ride. All right, I really am, because that's biblical. And I'm all for giving a person a helping hand up if they're really down on their luck. But what we're seeing today is we're seeing generation after generation after generation of people who are just sluggers. Now, I could get off on a big tangent here, a big diatribe, and I know that people could get really offended, but I'm just simply saying, this is God speaking. You go back to the Deuteronomy and Leviticus, God had a welfare program that was designed how?
They could clean the fields after they had been harvested.
Yeah, God said this. He told his people, when you go through your fields and you reap your harvest of your fields, you can only go through one time. And I don't want you reaping the corners of your field. When you go through your olive groves, when you go through your peaches and your, name it, your fruit, your pears, whatever, you could only go through one time. He says, because what I want is once you've gone through and harvested, I don't want you going through a second time. What is left, I want it left for the aliens and for the widow and for the orphan, for the stranger. But nobody was giving them a check and throw it in their face. God didn't say, well, I want you to go out and pick up all this fruit and give it to the poor. No. He made provisions for the poor, but they had to work for it. Mm-hmm. And what did that do for the poor? It gave them a sense of dignity because they were really working for their own living. See what I'm saying? That's God. You see how God is wise? Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? Like I said, you read something like this and people are going to take offense. But I'm not the one who said this. Because if you look at it, what is he saying there? How long will you lie down, O slugger? Now, who said that? Do you think I said that? Hey, well, that's mean spirit. I didn't say that. God said it.
I can hear you saying that.
Well, yeah. I could say a lot worse things. But I'm just saying, I'm reading what God has said here. It says, when will you rise from your sleep? When will you get out of bed? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and your poverty will come in like a vagabond, and your need like an armed man. You know what I'm saying? Just a little incremental steps at a time. Just keep hitting the snooze button. Just keep taking one little concession after another, after another, after another. And eventually, what you're going to be doing is becoming slothful, becoming lazy. And apply this spiritually, because this is so important. You know what it's going to take for us to get to heaven? I just flat out believe it. It's going to take diligence. Because God made us to know Him, love Him, serve Him with a whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. And I just can't see it where people say, well, you know what happens? Little incremental steps at a time. They say, well, you know what? I'm not going to go to Bible study tonight. I'm just going to watch some TV. My program's on. I'm a little tired. Now, I'm not putting people down if they don't come to Bible study, but apply it to Bible study. Apply it to a prayer meeting. Apply it to going to church. Apply it to having your quiet time. In other words, make little concessions and say, well, you know, a little bit more TV, a little bit. You know what? In the latest Time magazine, the statistic I read, it says that the average American spends 58 hours a week watching TV. Now, that's over 2.5 solid days a week. Now, what time do they have for God? Mm. I mean, there is none. There is none. So you got to ask, well, if God made us to know Him, love Him, and serve Him with a whole heart, mind, soul, and strength, then we got to take inventory here. Now, I realize, too, that people can say, well, you know, you don't want to get into a situation where you're just doing a lot of work. And I'm saying, right. Go back to the church of Ephesus. Why did Jesus rebuke that church? He says, I know your deeds, okay? He says, you're doing all of these great things. You know, as a matter of fact, your deeds of late are better than they were at first. But I have this one thing against you. What did he have against them?
They lost their
first love. Now, how did they lose that first love?
Their work for him became more important than him.
Yeah, in other words, I really believe strongly that what we need is to have not just a balance, but our focus has got to be, okay, spending time alone with God. That's where we get our first love, alone with God. But that takes diligence too. It takes a discipline. It takes, hey, I'm going to turn this TV off and spend time with God. I'm going to turn this TV off and I'm going to go to a Bible study. I'm going to turn this TV off and get with God's people. That takes a discipline. That takes a decision. All right? But once you do that, then you cultivate the first love. Then all the work you do for God, then it's meaningful. There's a lot of people today just doing a lot of work for God. In other words, they're just doing a lot of religious activity. but they have no personal relationships that's being developed with God. That's why he says, to know him, to love him, to serve him with a whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. That's why God made us. And look at the way it breaks down. I mean, when you give God your all, it doesn't mean you put your head in a bucket and then you fire a shotgun into it and you dismiss your brains. No, you love God with all your mind. You read, you study, you become a workman who's able to divide the word of truth correctly. But look at the people today. They won't pick up their Bible. They won't read it. They have no idea what it's saying, but they said they read it. And even the ones that are reading it, more and more of them are dismissing it out of hand as just being a book of fairy tales and myths and legends. It's a literary work that doesn't need to be taken seriously. I mean, I've heard the whole dribble before, and all I'm saying is this. You want to know God with your whole heart, mind, soul, and strength? Well, you got to incorporate his word, and you got to be diligent about studying his word. Anyway, I didn't want to get off on a big diatribe here, but you could write volumes about this. Just those few verses that we read about a sluggard. And Solomon repeats this virtually verbatim when we get to Proverbs chapter 24. Anyway, look what he says in verse 12. He says, a worthless person, a wicked man, is one who walks with a perverse mouth, who winks with his eyes, who signals with his feet, who points with his finger, who with perversity in his heart continually devises evil, who spreads strife. This, I want to read a little bit further down, because it talks about this guy who spreads strife, because in verse 15 it says, therefore his calamity will come suddenly, instantly he will be broken, there will be no healing. There are six things which the Lord hates, yes, seven which are an abomination to him: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that run rapidly to do evil, a false witness who utters lies, and one who spreads strife among brothers. Now look at that. You look at this verse 14, it says, who with perversity in his heart continually devises evil, who spreads strife, and then among the seven things that God hates, and the thing that he finds most abominable, is look at that verse 19, the latter part of it, and one who spreads strife among brothers. That's something that's really an abomination to God. In Hebrews it says, see to it that no root of bitterness spring up among you. Why? Least
many become defiled.
Many become defiled. You know what I'm saying? When he's talking about here, a worthless, now this is what the Bible says, a worthless person, a wicked man. Now, the shallow thinker, the fuzzy thinker is going to read that and say, well, you know, that's just being very, very mean-spirited. That's being judgmental. That's being intolerable. That's being hateful. You know, the whole labels are going to be light, didn't you? But it's God that says this. God's the one that's saying, a worthless person, a wicked man. All right? It's one who walks with a perverse mouth. In other words, he's always speaking out of both sides of his mouth. He's talking behind your back. He's talking behind your back. You know, when they were translating the Bible into various languages, in some cultures, some groups of people, there were certain words that they have a very, very difficult time translating from one language to another. But regardless of what language, what culture, what race of people that they were translating the Bible for, they never had a problem coming up with a word for hypocrite, because that's known in every language. They'd say, well, a man with two faces, a man with forked tongue. People understood what that means. This is a perverse man who kind of smiles to your face and stabs you in the back, who winks with his eyes, who signals with his feet. In other words, he's saying one thing to a person, but then looking at another person like, wink, wink, nod, nod. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know what he's telling the guy is a flat-out lie. He's being disingenuous. This is what God is talking about here, that these are the type of people. They're dishonest in their hearts, with perversity in his heart continually devises, who spreads strife. And that's one thing God really hates. He listed there. And then he says, well, this type of person is going to be instantly broken someday. But he also says in 16, there are six things which the Lord hates, seven which are an abomination to him. What? Haughty eyes? The proud person? Look at how many proud people there are today. And what I mean by that is, you know, some of the proudest people, the most arrogant people, in my opinion, they are the intelligentsia. Look at all academia. The most of it, they're God haters. There's two times that it says that Jesus marveled. Two times that he says that he marveled in the Gospels. What were those two times?
The unbelief of a city and the belief of a Gentile.
Good. He marveled at the faith of the Roman centurion, thinking, you know what? In all of Israel, I haven't seen such faith as this man. Now, he was a Roman. He was a pagan. Well, when I say a pagan, he was highly respected of the Jews because he did believe in God, but he wasn't born and raised with the knowledge of God the way the Jews were. So Jesus marveled at his faith. But then when Jesus went back to his own hometown, it says that people said, well, we know this guy. Who is this guy? Where did he get this authority? Where did he get this power? And they rejected him. They said, we know this guy. Where did he come from? And, you know, it says that Jesus marveled at their unbelief. Now, here's the thing. You know what? I marvel. I really do. I marvel at the unbelief of doctors. I marvel at that. You would think, man, you know, take a specialist, take an optometrist, take, I don't care what it is, take any part of the body. And you would wonder, how do these people, in all honesty and with a straight face, say there's no God? Now, of course, not all of them do, but a lot of them do. And I marvel at that. I mean, look at God's creation. I don't care what it is. I don't care whether it's a drop of blood. I don't care whether it's a, you know, a stellar galaxy or a blade of grass. We won't ever know the fullness of anything. They used to talk about a simple cell. There's no such thing as a simple cell. A quote-unquote simple cell is more complex than a modern city. So you almost marvel. I mean, I marvel at the scientist who says there's no God. Doesn't that characterize haughty eyes?
Oh, yeah.
All right, it's just pure pride. And then he says a lying tongue. I mean, that just speaks for itself. But look at the lies that are being perpetrated in our schools today. If I really, really believed in evolution, if I believed that everything just came into being all by its little self, just out of a big explosion, and we all just evolved from some mud hole, and we're all just going to live and die and be buried in some dirt hole. If I really, really, really believed that with all of my heart, and I was a quote-unquote scientist, you know what I would say to the creationists? I'd say, bring it on. Bring it on. I'd say, bring your stuff here. I'm going to make a fool out of all of you. But they will not allow you to present the other side. You talk about lying tongue. This whole evolutionary baloney is nothing but a big lie. It just is. And he says, and hands that shed innocent blood. Now look at this country.
Wow.
Look at this country. We've murdered almost 50 million unborn children. And God hates that. It's an abomination to him. And we're not going to get away with it. We're just not. It says, verse 18, a heart that devises wicked plans and feet that run rapidly to do evil. I mean, a heart that devises wicked plans, that could cover a lot of ground. But just use one example. Look at the lawyers today in terms of all those lawsuits that are going on that are bogus. Now, let me read this. A heart that devises wicked plans. I mean, a lot of that, you can see that in our courts, that they have no interest in truth. No interest in what is really right, but they're just suing left and right. How many people, you know, they get in the slightest little fender bender, and then they say, oh, my back, oh, my head, my, you know, just sue. Well, you know, that's devising wicked plans. Now, you know, if you are definitely hurt, that's something else. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about what's a lot of it that goes on. And feet that run rapidly to do evil. Look at this country. The culture war is lost. It just is. And that's because there's so many people that run rapidly to do evil. And that's just the flat-out truth. And he says, a false witness who utters lies. Well, that speaks for itself. But like I said, look at all the lies that are being perpetrated all over the place. You know, you know what? Interesting thing. The Indians used to have a way of determining who a person would tell a lie. If something was done and nobody owed up to it, everybody they suspected, they just line them up. They'd heat up on a knife in a fire. And then they just say, stick out your tongue. And each person, they go down and put this hot knife on a person's tongue. And they could tell the person who was lying. You ever have a hot iron and you want to see how hot it is, and so you wet your finger to just, and you go, tss. All right, it doesn't hurt your finger because there's that little moisture there. Well, a person who's lying, very often their tongue will dry up when they're put on the spot. And so a hot knife touching your tongue is not going to hurt a person who's not lying because their tongue is moist, all right? But the person who's lying, their tongue's all dried up. Wow. And it's going to stick to it.
We ought to bring that back in the courts instead of swearing.
We ought to do this to every politician. I'm telling you right now. You know, get up there. Everybody's running for office, man. Stick out your tongue. Let's see. It says, a false witness who utters lies and one who spreads strife among brothers. And I always talk about the spreading of strife. The people who claim to be Christian can stir up so much muck and mire and filth and garbage by tearing down another person's reputation. If I could get so, angry about it, you can imagine what God would get when this is strife is stirred up among people who are supposed to be brothers, all right? And he says here in that verse 20, he says, my son, observe the commandments of your father. Do not forsake the teaching of your mother. Bind them continually on your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you walk about, they will guide you. When you sleep, they will watch over you. And when you awake, they will talk to you. For the commandment is a lamp and a teaching is a light. And reproofs for discipline are a way of life, to keep you from the evil woman and from a smooth tongue of an adulteress. Now, before we go any further, look what he's saying here. He's talking to a young person now, because you go back to the beginning of the book of Proverbs, he's talking to younger people, all right? But this is his advice. He says, verse 20, my son, observe the commandments of your father and do not forsake the teaching of your mother. Bind them continually on your heart and tie them around your neck. Now, that's very, very good advice. As a matter of fact, I mean, God said that honor your mother and your father. But you know, if you go back to Exodus chapter 21, this is what God said. He who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. And then he goes on to say in verse 17 of chapter 21, he says, he who curses his father or mother shall surely be put to death. Now, I've never read it anywhere in the scriptures where anybody was put to death for that. But the very fact that it's a law in the books says a lot about how God feels about this situation. He says, you curse your mother and father, you're going to be executed. You strike your mother and father, you're going to be executed. Now, why is that?
No, they take God's place.
There it is. Because the parents stand in the place of God. All right? And to strike your parents is like striking God. To curse your parents is like cursing God. And I'm telling you, look at where we're at today. One of the things that Paul listed in Timothy, he said there are 19 different adjectives that he used to describe what men will be like in the last days. He said that they will be disobedient to parents. Look what's happening all over the place today. And I can tell you, you could always bring it right back to the nucleus of the family. The family is just dysfunctional. It's falling apart, flying apart. Most children today are being raised by either one parent or out of wedlock. Some are inner city kids there, I mean, over 70% of them are born out of wedlock. They don't have a father figure. And then you got the situation where over 80% of the guys in prison grew up without a father. And we got these buffoons that are running around saying, well, you know what, you don't really need a mother or father, and especially you don't need a father. I mean, mother can do the same thing. You see these Hollywood idiots that have children out of wedlock and they don't have a father. Well, you get a situation where people just think, well, parents are not necessary. You know, a father's not necessary. And God's saying, hey, just the opposite. And you know what? Every single study, every single research, every single poll, everything that's been done shows that when you have an intact family with a mother and a father, male and female, all right, the children that are raised in that household do far better financially, mentally, emotionally. They have fewer behavioral problems. They do much better in school. They do much better as far as their future is concerned. That's just a flat-out truth. But look what's happened today. And it's because this whole concept of a mother and father has been so minimized. Now, granted, they're always going to have somebody come along and say, well, what if you got some bad parents? Well, let me tell you something. You can always find exceptions. There are parents, I've read of parents who are using their kids on the internet for pornography. I've read of parents who, you know, I've seen a documentary where we had gypsies running, using all their kids to run through the store, grab as much stuff and run out. That's the exception. Most parents will have the welfare of their children, you know, at heart. Okay, most parents. But, you know, that, of course, is being thrown out the window, too. But still, all in all right, what he's saying is, hey, listen, when you're growing up, when you're young, listen to your parents. That's what he's telling us here. Listen to your parents. Because that's what he's saying. He says here, observe the commandments of your father. Do not forsake your teaching of your mother. Bind them continually on your heart and tie them around your neck. In other words, hey, it's not just for show. It's in your heart. But then when you bind them around your neck, it's obvious for all to see. It says a lot as far as a parent's responsibility. And, you know, and God is saying, hey, man, you better listen to your parents. And how many people today are in jail or on drugs or on doing it because they don't listen to their parents, right? Mm-hmm. He says, when you walk about, they will guide you. And when you sleep, they will watch over you. And when you awake, they will talk to you. In other words, the counsel of your parents. Then he says here, for the commandment is a lamp and a teaching is a light. And reproofs of discipline are a way of life. So what he's saying here, what your parents say, it says it's a commandment. Their commandment is a lamp and a teaching is light. Now, what does that remind you of?
God's word being lamp.
Yeah.
The light to
good, good. Because you go back to Psalm 119. David said this, "Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day. Your commandments make me wiser than my enemies, for they are ever mine. I have more insight than all of my teachers, for your testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the aged, because I have observed your precepts. I have restrained my feet from every evil way, that I may keep your word. I have not turned aside from your ordinances, for you yourself have taught me. How sweet are your words to my taste, yes, sweeter than honey to my mouth. From your precepts I get understanding, therefore I hate evil, every evil way." Then he says this, "Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path." That's God's word. But then what is God saying here? He's saying the counsel of a parent is basically the same thing in that verse 23, "For the commandment is a lamp and a teaching is a light." As far as the parents are concerned. And he says, "Reproofs for discipline are a way of life." Meaning what? Meaning, if your parents love you, they're going to be quick to discipline you. And Solomon even goes so as far as to say, if you do not discipline your child, it proves you hate your child. Why is that? Because we're all born with a fallen nature. We just are. And if you don't train up children the way they're supposed to go when they're younger, the old saying, as the twig is bent, so grows the tree. Gail could tell you, she's in a teaching profession. You see a situation now more and more and more and more that there's this defiance, not just towards parents, but it's carried over to the schools. And then, of course, when it's carried over to the schools, then it's carried over to the police. It's carried over to society. In other words, when you have a situation where you've got an incorrigible child, you don't raise them up the way he's supposed to be, you don't discipline them, you don't reprove them, what happens? He becomes a situation where he's just a troublemaker. And then, a lot of times now, parents will not take the side of a teacher. They'll say, well, you're just racist, or whatever other word they want to use. When in actuality, all they're doing is giving this kid a green light to go to prison. Because that's where he's going to end up being. I told my kids when they were growing up, I said, hey man, if there's ever a problem over there, I'm taking your teacher's side. End of story. You know, well, I just did.
Just don't tell the teacher.
Yeah, well, I'm just telling, you know what I'm saying? I'm saying, hey, I want them to know. I'm not going to go over there and cuss out the teacher because my child's misbehaving, because what does that tell your child? Yeah. Man, you see what I'm saying? I mean, that's what's happening today.
Mm-hmm. Huh? My father always had the belt hanging over the stair railing as the ultimate reminder. Family is not a democracy. Mm-hmm. You don't get a vote. Mm-hmm. It's a dictatorship, mom and dad.
Yeah, right.
Lovingly.
Yeah. Okay, now he's getting into another train of thought, but he's saying this, that obeying the commandments of your parents, because he says this, what is it going to do for you? If you obey your mother and father, it says in verse 24, to keep you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of an adulteress. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her capture you with her eyelids. For on account of a harlot, one is reduced to a loaf of bread, and an adulteress hunts for a precious life. Can a man take fire to his bosom, and his clothes not be burned? Or can a man walk on hot coals, and his feet not be scorched? So is the one who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her will not go unpunished. Men do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he is hungry, but if he is found, he must repay sevenfold. He must give all the substance of his house. The one who commits adultery with the woman is lacking sense. He who would destroy himself does it. Wounds and disgrace he will find, and his reproach will not be blotted out. For jealousy enrages a man, and he will not spare in a day of vengeance. He will not accept any ransom, nor will he be satisfied, though you give him many gifts. Now, he's talking about, okay, listening to the counsel of your parents. One of the things that he says you're going to avoid is getting into immoral, illicit relationships. Look what's happening today. How many parents, they're lax. They don't tell the kids, look, I don't want you hanging around with this crowd. I don't want you hanging around with this person or that person. Or they put some strict boundaries on them when they're dating, as far as curfews, as far as when they're being. I mean, if a person really loves their child, they're going to be doing just that. But now, today, it's like parents are even just, they're abdicating their responsibility. They just feel like, well, kids are going to do it, so, you know, just be safe. Here's some contraception, here's some condoms, or whatever. But if you look here, if a parent really has the well-being of a child, their best interest at heart, then they're going to be giving them these guidelines, these moral guidelines. And they're going to avoid a lot of pitfalls. Look how many people today have come down with sexually transmitted diseases. It's epidemic. It's pandemic. I mean, as far as syphilis and gonorrhea and chlamydia, and now it's AIDS, and a lot of young people are coming down with all these sexually transmitted diseases. And some of them are incurable. You can trace it back almost all the time because they don't listen to their parents. And that's what God is saying here. And he's saying that if you get involved in some of these illicit relationships, it could really end up being a situation where you can even lose your life. And so this is advice, right? This is advice that God is giving. And it's advice to everybody, but it's primarily to a young person. But here again, look at how many politicians have gone out in flames because they wouldn't listen to this kind of advice. Look at the people who are out in high visibility as far as the ministry is concerned, who have blown their whole ministry because they can't keep their pants on. Look what happens. Their ministry gets destroyed. They give God's enemies occasion to blaspheme. They create a situation where weaker Christians stumble. I mean, this is what happens. So you see the advice there? Anybody have anyone to add or share?
Yeah, I think